Welcome to the Business of Government Hour, a conversation about management with a government executive who is changing the way government does business. The Business of Government Hour is produced by the IBM Center for the Business of Government, which was created in 1998 to encourage discussion and research into new approaches to improving government effectiveness. You can find out more about the center by visiting us on the web at businessofgovernment.org. And now, the Business of Government Hour.
Welcome to a special edition of the Business of Government Hour, a conversation with authors exploring national security, power, and intelligence in the 21st century. I'm Michael Keegan, your host and managing editor of the Business of Government magazine. Military force is typically the bedrock of a nation's power. In this complex and dynamic world of changing demands, the nature of security today requires that it be conceived more broadly than ever before. Some have called for a new, vibrant strategic direction for U.S. national security and foreign policy. Today's context presents a unique set of challenges and requires a new way of thinking about American power, security, and leadership. For the United States to be an effective world leader, how does it strategically balance all three aspects of its power, defense, diplomacy, and development? What are the strategic threats facing the U.S. today? And how can the use of smart power address some of these complex global problems? We will explore these questions and so much more with our very special guest, General Anthony Zinni, former commander of the U.S. Central Command and author, most recently, of Leading the Charge, Leadership Lessons from the Battlefield to the Boardroom. General Zinni, welcome to the program. It's wonderful to have you.
Thank you.
Also joining our conversation from IBM is Frank Strickland. Frank, welcome.
Thank you.
General Zinni, we need to understand power and how it's changing in the 21st century. Would you outline the dimensions and aspects of power that mark world politics in the 21st century?
Well, I think we have to understand how much the world has changed in the last two decades, beginning with the fall of the Soviet Union. We live in a very different world for a number of reasons. It's much more interdependent. I think globalization, the rise of information technology, the migrations of people have caused this. There's been power shifts. There's probably more balance of power in the world. I think we've learned today that military power no longer has the clout that maybe it once did. Right now, I think economic power, social influence, political influence, those dimensions of power may be greater or at least as great as the projection of force around the world. And I think we as a nation, the United States, have to learn how to use that, how to integrate all the elements of power more effectively in this world. And I think we haven't mastered it yet. I think we have a long way to go to understand that. I was impressed with the Obama national security strategy that came out last May because it identified the foundation of our national security as education, the economy, and our energy dependence, that these were areas we had to work on. What was impressive about that is that it was an acknowledgement that it isn't just projection of influence or power in a military sense. It was looking internally at the foundations of our own system that need to be strengthened in this different environment. So I think in that respect, it's been a major change.
General Zinni, after 1989, you point out that the peace dividend went the way of Checkpoint Charlie and the Berlin Wall. The New World Order turned into the New World Disorder. Would you elaborate on this perspective? And more importantly, what opportunities were missed?
I think there was a misbelief at the time that the world would self-order. I understand there could be good reason for that. I think President Bush, H.W. Bush, Gorbachev, other leaders of the world really believe that, you know, after coming so close to rendering our planet a cinder, you know, with the nuclear power that we had, the East versus West tensions for over half a century, I think people believe that there would be such a sense of relief that we would now turn away from military spending, there would be a peace dividend, that there would be more of a self-ordering, the world would be more cooperative. There was a lot of hope that there would be regional and global integration of interests and coming together, more balance of power and wealth in the world. But none of that really materialized. And I think the big mistake was, unlike at the end of World War II, where the United States and really provided the resources, the wherewithal, the strategic guidance to reshape the world in major ways, the Marshall Plan, the way we reconstructed our own government, the rise of the development banks, and things that helped reshape a world in a new, different environment, it didn't happen. I was in European Command at the time. And Secretary of State Baker, through Ambassador Rich Armitage, was trying to form a cooperative Marshall Plan for the former republics of the Soviet Union. And I actually was working for Ambassador Armitage at the time to do that. And what impressed me was the lack of interest in that, both in the United States and with our allies that we were trying to encourage to participate in that. It was kind of frustrating. I think that was an attempt to do something like what Marshall and others did at the end of World War II, to take a sort of a fresh strategic look at the world, see how the leading and developed nations could best influence the kinds of positive conditions that needed to develop. And since that didn't occur, it kind of self-ordered or self-disordered in ways that we realize today.
Generals, any turning from those missed opportunities to today and looking forward, what are some of the key strategic threats facing the U.S. today?
Well, I think the threats are much more varied than they were before. I mean, obviously, in the period of the Cold War, even before that, we looked at nation states or coalitions of nation states that presented a military threat, and that was the sum total of what we saw as existential threats. Now they're far more varied. I think the greatest threats right now are economic or things that destabilize us that aren't necessarily being projected by sovereign entities in any way. They're borderless. They're non-state entities like extremist groups and others that may present the greatest physical threat. We also have challenges in terms of economic cooperation and competition. I think that we're seeing a lot of reordering in the world. Many historians may look back at this period and describe it as a key point in time where the Islamic world reordered in some fashion or changed or transformed. And we can see that going on now in the streets of Cairo and Damascus and other places. So what I would describe as the key strategic threats is just a whole series of things. And they come in the area of political, social, economic, and security threats. They're much more varied in that respect. When I was writing my last book, I had a friend of mine who said it was like sleeping with a cobra for 50 years. And you woke up and realized the cobra was dead, never bit you. And now the room was full of bees and they were stinging you. You know, no one sting could kill you, but the cumulative effect could be devastating. And I thought, I used that actually in my book, stole it from him, but he described it very well. So I think it isn't sort of these monolithic single threats. It's just a whole collection of them, and they span the spectrum from political, economic, social, and security.
General Zinni, under the Goldwater-Nichols Act, each administration is required to submit a national security strategy. And you alluded earlier to the Obama administration national security strategy. Would you elaborate on the importance of this strategy? What are the key components of a national security strategy, and to what extent do we in the U.S. need an overarching strategy to deal coherently with these problems that you've been talking about?
Well, the Goldwater-Nichols Act very correctly required the president to produce this in 150 days and then to every year after that at a specific time to renew it or revalidate it. And it was tied to the budget process. It was supposed to provide the guidance and the strategic structure to the budget decisions that went on in Congress. Very few presidents have ever delivered on time or bothered to update it. As a matter of fact, to my shock, very few people in government even read the National Security Strategy. So the budget process is sort of a backwards process. People begin to drill down, and obviously decisions are made on funding based on local politics, pet projects, special interests. And they're not based on a strategic design. And that was the attempt of the Goldwater-Nichols, to get a strategic design behind something. I can see this in defense. I mean, to the credit of Secretary Gates, Admiral Mullen, I think they're seriously trying to reduce the defense budget, recognizing the realities of our economic situation. But I see us cherry-picking programs, sort of cherry-picking roles and missions. I don't see a step back and say, let's erase the board and start with the strategic design. Let's define what our military should be for the 21st century, where it should be. I mean, why do we have troops in Germany and Japan and South Korea? Maybe there's good reason, but have they been revalidated since they were put there based on old strategies, Carter doctrines, Nixon doctrines, post-World War II or Cold War environments? You know, I don't think any of that's been done. So the component parts of a strategy obviously are to define our vision, you know, where we see our country going, our power and purpose in the world, our involvement, You have to define our strategic interests, our vital national interests. We have to define the partnerships and alliances that mean something to us today and how we intend to support them and participate. You have to define the threats and how you intend to deal with them. And there's no answer that fits all the threats that you face. Some you may contain and deter. Some you may deal with directly. But I don't see that happening. I even in the recent Obama national security strategy, as I said, I was impressed that we took a look at the foundational internal issues as a beginning, which I think is important. But we didn't go through the detail of all this. And I don't see, even if we did, that guidance is being taken seriously by everybody. I just look at this current involvement, you know, recently in Libya. How do we get thrust into it? What are our vital national interests? What is our objective, political objective? What are the military tasks that are going to lead to that? We sort of knee-jerked or backed in to this, in my view. And that's what happens when you don't have a strategy. And the most important part of a strategy is to establish priorities. You can't, in this day and age, be all things to all people and meet all needs. So what is the priority? And what are the hard choices you're willing to make? And I don't see that today. And I think that's what the Goldwater-Nichols Act wanted to achieve. We probably need a greater Goldwater-Nichols Act that allows for more integration of our agencies and departments in government. That's woefully inadequate. We find that out after every crisis. 9/11 Commission, the Homeland Security Commission, you know, complain about the lack of integration, and the fixes they recommend just add more bureaucracy, and I don't see that they really solve the problem. Goldwater-Nichols Act did for the military, I think, truly created the right kind of integration, but we have a failure to do it on a larger scale for government.
General Zinni, shifting the emphasis of U.S. foreign policy from one that relies heavily on military might to one that elevates the value of diplomacy development will take strong leadership, a decisive strategy, and ample resources to ensure its success. Would you elaborate on the specific organizational and operational changes required for the U.S. to be successful in this area? And how does your Civilian Affairs Command concept factor into this process?
I think that this has become a significant issue. We can no longer resolve everything with just the military. The military, I think, is the first to realize this. The battlefields of today are very complex, and they have issues that go beyond just the security requirement. We should have learned that from Vietnam on. And so the military felt very strongly that we need partners on the battlefield that work the political, the economic, the social conditions that take place. In many of the conflicts today, the military dimension is not enough in and of itself if it's resolved to settle the situation. It used to be you could handle these sorts of things sequentially, take care of the military business first, defeat the bad guys, you know, capture the capital, remove the regime, and then get on with reconstruction. Reconstruction begins now just as the boots cross the line of departure. We do a great job, our military does, I think, in being able to handle their part of the action. It's the other parts that are far inadequate, and some of that has to do with funding and resources and organization. Some of it has to do with the culture. You have a military that, for example, are exceptional planners. I don't see that in the other dimensions. There's the question of scope and scale. Our military is capable of operating on a large scale, defeating national threats, coalition threats. I don't see we have the capacity to rebuild societies on that scale. Even going back to World War II, it was the military fundamentally in Japan and Germany, they got saddled with this. The military becomes stuck with this problem of rebuilding. Look at what General Petraeus did in Iraq and elsewhere. It falls to the military. We see the failures of the civilian side. I think the CPA, the Coalition Provisional Authority, its predecessor, the organization that was sent in, was way undermanned, did not have the competence, the manning level, the understanding of the culture, the history, the planning that would have had to go into reconstructing an Iraq or an Afghanistan. I don't see in the cultures of the State Department, USAID, and other institutions that they're able to handle that scope. They're able to do the detailed plans. What shocked me when I was a commander of CENTCOM, I was required to build war plans. I had them for places like Iraq. I certainly, when I was involved in Korea, I saw the Korean war plan. I don't see the counterpart plans for reconstructing of societies after a conflict. When we get engaged in at any level, whether it's a very low intensity or very high intensity, I don't see the planning and the effort going in. I tried as the commander of CENTCOM to engage these other organizations in doing this, and just did not find that they had the resources and, frankly, the will to engage and the background, the understanding. I was involved in a policy advisory group to the Senate Foreign Relations Committee. Senator Lugar and then Senator Biden had co-chaired our group to look at what we needed to do to create this kind of a total organization when we got involved in these kinds of situations. And, you know, it was frustrating because nobody saw that you could change the bureaucracy. Wisely, I don't think the senators wanted to commit resources to something that wasn't going to materially improve the other side.
What are the characteristics of an effective leader? We will ask General Anthony Zinni, author of Leading the Charge, Leadership Lessons from the Battlefield to the Boardroom, when our conversation continues on the Business of Government Hour.